know what they say, two humble on is a coincidence, but three humble on, that's a trend.
That's a psychic net that controls the minds of the people, they say. That old saying.
Yeah, that old canard. No, that old chestnut.
There we go.
There we go.
Bingo.
Live from the Mundangerous City Center in New York City, I'm your host, Shane.
And I'm your host, Yishin.
And welcome to episode 295 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about adventuring in urban environments. But first, the party faces justice in the Gates of Morning campaign. And later, the urban cowboy revives John Travolta's career in the Character Creation Forge. I always thought that was Look Who's Talking. No, just me.
Yeah, he had a flop right before Urban Cowboy, and while Urban Cowboy was not as successful as Saturday Night Fever or Grease, it was a recovery from moment by moment.
Someone's been reading Wikipedia.
I have been reading Wikipedia.
You know what? If you've got questions that can't be answered by Wikipedia, you can send them in to us, because coming up very shortly in episode 300, we're doing our Mega Mailbag special, as we do every centennial episode, which has happened many times now already, because we've been doing this for 6 years.
Yeah, if you send us a question that we don't know the answer to, we will just make something up.
Yeah.
Like, if you just want to know a fact and we don't know it, we'll just make it up for you. We'll tell you we're making up this fact on your behalf. Mm-hmm. That will be part of the episode.
Sometimes also, we'll say we're making it up, but we actually did a lot of lengthy research and are giving you the correct answer, but we're pretending like we already knew it.
Yeah, because you have to do your own research sometimes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you can't just trust the experts who
right.
have podcasts.
Be a free thinker. Listen to Dr. Joe Rogan.
God. Don't do that. Wait, if this
like
is your
Aaron
first
Rogers.
Episode, if this is your first episode, that is not who we are. Okay. Anyway, questions about anything, you know, RPGs, probably, but really, whatever. We'll answer them.
All right. Where are we in the Gates of Morning campaign?
So the Gates of Morning campaign is our 5th edition D&D game set in Eberron, a sequel of sorts to the original Morning Glory campaign. And in Flamekeep, the seat of the Church of the Silver Flame, the party is hunting down a rogue sect of House Churrasco. Seeking to prove that Malak Othera was indeed a mind seed and a quarry infiltrator, the party has asked the Keeper of the Flame, Jayla Darren, to question the corpse herself. She casts Speak with Dead and addresses the changeling. "Who are you?" she asks. A woman's voice issues forth. "I just wanted to be overlooked, to live a quiet life, to keep Meryl safe. I didn't want to be a changeling. I just wanted to be Johara, a simple woman. But then I became Vakri, and then I became Malak Othera."
The party recognizes Johara as one of the refugees who died alongside them on the Day of Mourning. They also realize that if Johara was a changeling in disguise, it's possible her daughter Meryl was too. The nobles in the room look dismayed at the corpse's words, but seem torn, not wanting to believe, but unable to deny the evidence that's been laid bare by the spell the Keeper has cast.
Jayla weighs in, declaring that it does seem that maybe there is something to the party's story, despite how far-fetched it sounds. She looks concerned, but she pushes the party to suggest the next question themselves.
"Why did you infiltrate the Silver Flame?" they ask.
A breathy, disembodied voice responds, "To install a Hanbalan." Jayla and High Cardinal Crozen exchange a look of worry, but Blood Regent Diani and Zara Silvervein look confused, which the party takes to mean that they were unaware of the true identity of their compatriot. The party, though, knows that the Hanbalani monuments help the quarry control the minds of the reagent populace, and only they know that the Mindseed Elaine was trying to install one inside the Tower of the Twelve, a fact that they decide to keep to themselves for right now.
Uh-oh. You know what they say, two humble on is a coincidence, but three humble on, that's a trend.
That's a psychic net that controls the minds of the people, they say. That old saying.
Yeah, that old canard. No, that old chestnut.
There we go. Bingo. So Jayla waves the party forward to continue with the questioning. Hoping to root out any other disguised agents, they ask, what are the assumed identities of other infiltrators of the Silver Flame? The corpse replies that it knows only of Kepli and Minto, and Zara Silvervane nods to the two dead guards the party fought when he hears those two names.
So, pressing their advantage, the party asks, if we wanted to undo your work, what would be the best steps to take?
After a long pause, the breathy voice responds, foment a civil war between the Blood Regent and the Keeper of the Silver Flame. Jayla's eyes quickly dart down the hall toward the silvery light for a brief moment. Diani becomes extremely animated, protesting almost too loudly at the implication of her disloyalty, and Zaro, of course, backs her up. Cardinal Crozen, on his part, though, turns on the party, decrying the entire proceedings thus far as lies. Of course, for their part, the party just sort of looks at each other and is puzzled as to why a civil war in Thrain would hurt the quarry.
Jayla calms the din enough to ask for a final question. The party confers and follows up on that thread, asking why that would prevent Malik's plan.
Jayla, though, concentrates for a long moment, and instead of asking that question, she asks, what do you need to make sure your plan will work? The corpse responds, the ones who killed me. Crozen howls with certainty. Deceivers, he cries. He orders the party's arrest, and the guards in the room begin to advance.
Jayla looks stricken and eyes the party with disgust. The group realizes what the corpse meant. Elaine had also said that their bodies, infused with the energies of the morning, were critical to the Dreaming Dark's plan, but they dared not explain that right now. Instead, they protest, pointing to their discovery of a plot against the flame. The nobles will have none of it.
But Jayla intercedes. The small girl's voice booms with authority.
You have been found guilty of sedition, she says. I now pass the judgment of the flame. Summary execution.
A look of confusion and then horror dawns on the faces of Crozen and the nobles. Jayla brings a small hand to her lips and blows in the party's direction. The breath quickly grows to a gale that crashes into them, scouring their bodies, which disintegrate, leaving nothing behind but dust and ash in the wind. The end of the story. That's how the campaign ended.
All right. Well, we'll find out what campaign we're recapping next week.
All right. So this week we are continuing our series on adventuring in different kinds of environments, and this time we're talking about urban adventures. Shane, what's an urban environment? Is it a poorly named musical genre?
Yes. My time at a record label made me feel very odd about that choice. Anyway. Yes, so urban environments are, of course, cities and all the accompanying areas about them. So your narrow streets, your spacious plazas, your towering buildings, and the huddled masses living in their shadows.
Mm-hmm. All the people who failed the city. Cities are really a collection of sub-locations, all of which have unique elements. You might have the docks, the commercial district. Now you've got residential areas for the upper, middle, and lower classes. Temples and palaces, the undercity or sewers or cogs, depending on what genre you're playing in. The rooftops, of course, because where else are you going to parkour? The walls or the gates?
All these will have different environments and aesthetics. They might have different rules. You might be able to get away with a fight on the docks, but you're not going to get away having a fight in the palace garden. Right? And so a city is this collection of all these different things. You can almost think of it like what's different about, you know, each room or each section of a dungeon? Like, that's how a city works too, right? There's slightly different rules of engagement each place you go.
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite of the thing we get grumpy about in Star Wars, where you have entire planets with a single biome, right? Like, you can have one city, one location in like a relatively small area in a setting or a world, and it's like having a dozen different environments. So I guess, I don't know, maybe Coruscant is the best place in Star Wars to have adventures.
Well, wait, hang on. Coruscant is also a single biome. The biome is city.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like a dozen different environments.
Sure. The other thing that makes cities unique is that they are as much about the inhabitants as the environment, right? When you think of adventuring in a jungle, you might think of the animals that live there or the monsters that live there or the threats of the, you know, jungle itself, right? In a city, it's as much about the people who live in the city and how they shape the environment around them as it is about the physical stacks of bricks and cobblestone streets and straw thatched roofs and whatever.
Yeah, that kind of sets city adventures apart. Almost every other environment that we have talked about and will talk about, you can't assume that there are going to be people or humanoids or intelligent creatures to interact with. But in a city, if there aren't, then it's not a city, it's a ruin. And that's a totally different type of environment to play in. So think about, what is it about the particular city that you're in that makes it interesting? Or what kinds of things are you going to encounter that you wouldn't encounter elsewhere in this game? Are there alligators in the sewers? Or are there mutants or Morlocks in the sewers?
Is there preening nobility at the Duke's inauguration parade?
Oh, I guarantee it. Yes, of course there are.
Well, is there an inauguration parade in the city when you're there? You know, there's definitely not an inauguration parade in a smelly dungeon or in a hot, sticky, sweaty swamp.
I mean, now we have a plot hook.
Exactly.
Do you have mad scientists experimenting in the slums? Because, you know, the slums have different rules than the palace garden.
Right. Or maybe the mad scientist is, you know, sitting in the palace in his own little wing, but his experiments are hurting the slums. That feels like a properly industrialist approach. You might have evil cults attempting to summon fiends or even something worse in, you know, the dead of night.
And I'd say definitely every city has secret factions that are maneuvering against each other. Whether this is something like, you know, Planescape and Sigil, where they're literal factions that are wielding power against each other with, you know, different philosophical beliefs and tenets. Or if it's a very modern, very realistic game, there are always factions or groups or unions or political parties or what have you that are vying against each other. So let's talk about some of the challenges that you might face in a city.
Again, anytime you're talking about society, you have social class, right?
Yeah, because they live in a society. The PCs do.
Exactly. Well, they may not live in one, but they're certainly approaching one when they get to the city.
I play barbarian so that I don't live in a society.
Right. So, you know, lowborn often have fewer rights, or they might have limited physical access to some areas of the city. You know, they don't let Aladdin into the palace unless he sneaks in.
They just can't see that he's a diamond in the rough.
Exactly. And social class is going to often color the interactions that you have across the cityscape, right? A merchant is polite if he thinks you have coin. A noble might be rude or suspicious if she thinks you have coin, because why would you have coin? Did you steal it? What are you up to? Whereas like a street urchin may see you as a mark, right? He might see the party as, you know, a walking bag of loot who needs to be attacked and taken.
These ATMs just get up and walk around these days. I don't know what it is. Adventurers don't even notice a few hundred gold pieces.
Right.
I think when we're talking about the challenges in a city, the cool thing about having all of these involve other people for the most part is you can apply them either as challenges that exist within the city, right? Like someone who is lowborn A lowborn NPC has difficulty entering certain parts of the city or the nobles' quarter, and that is a challenge that the party engages with, either finding a way to get them in or something like that. Or all of these challenges can be levied at the PCs themselves. If they are lowborn or highborn or whatever, they are subject to these particular strictures.
Right. But, if they're perceived to be, right? They might be nobles in their lands, and that doesn't mean anything here.
Right. You might be dealing with cultural challenges. Some cities are cosmopolitan. Others are insular or maybe xenophobic. You've got a lot of local customs. And like you said, these can conflict with the PC norms of, from wherever that the PCs are actually from. They can also differ in different parts of the city, right? The nobles district has different customs than the docks.
Yeah. And I think that sort of like fish out of water scenario is common. Like, that isn't unique to cities. I think what's different between like running into that in a small village or the you meet in a tavern thing, right, is that in a city it becomes oppressive, right? Like, it shapes your experience of everything you do in a city, whereas it's probably an incident that is overcome in a smaller location, right? Because the city, what makes cities different is that humanity in the city does not respond to you, right? It resists your pressing against it in a way that like smaller groups of people adopt change because you as PCs have the agency to push them.
Yeah, there are just too many people. In a village of 50, even 100 powerful PCs can essentially do whatever they want. Once you've attained, high enough level or enough magic items or whatever. But in the city, it doesn't actually really matter because there are just too many people for you to sort of like mechanically handle if people aren't on your side. Like, you actually need to sway them or convince authorities.
Right.
Couple ways to do that. One, of course, is money. Often one of the complaints about RPGs is that you don't really know what to do with all your money. Like, oh, I've got too many credits burning a hole in my pocket, and I guess I'll just buy another spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? There's no limit to how much you can spend on bribes in a city in order to get stuff done.
Right. If you want to drain the coffers, just have them get involved in local politics. Let them back a candidate for their local ombudsman.
We're just trying to redistrict our HQ.
Right.
Exactly. So we can add like a couple more containment units for the ghosts. That shouldn't be a problem, right? No, not if you have enough money. Not at all. Speaking of not being able to fight back against the tide of humanity, you're also dealing with legal authority, who are often backed up by weapons.
Mm, yes. So you've got to think about, what is the legal system here like? How strictly is it enforced? How evenly is it enforced?
Not evenly.
Probably not evenly. That is a pretty big hallmark of cities. But even at the top, right? Like, you might have environments where, the laws are more like guidelines, like Tortuga, for example. If you stumble out of a bar in a fight and you shoot somebody in Tortuga, it's probably fine. If you do that in Charleston, you're probably going to jail.
What's the saying? For my friends, everything. For my enemies, the law. So what are the punishments that are available in this city look like? Is it death? That's actually kind of more difficult to adjudicate in a game, because once your PCs run afoul of the law, now you have to figure out why they're not dying and like having to re-roll.
Yeah, it really puts a fine point on that escape scene that you're going to be needing here.
Yeah, it's so interesting how like, oh, these backwards medieval cities all have pretty much abolished the death penalty and really just throw people in jail for a night or two to sort of think things through.
Right. you might have something like expulsion, right? You might get kicked out of the city or like forced into like a work detail or, sent to a colony or like some type of like, war front. You might be drafted or press ganged.
And I think, obviously these are all great potential backstories for your PC in the first place. They're also obvious plot hooks for NPCs or to just get your party moving in a direction when they're in the city. Because I think that's one thing that can, that's a challenge in and of itself, is sort of the analysis paralysis of when you get to a city and they're, you know, it's no longer the one village with the town center and like there's, you know, there's the one shop and there's the blacksmith and, you know, who am I going to go talk to? Now suddenly it's, what district full of 10,000 people do you want to go to? And now the game we're trying to play that we've been, you know, running sort of like realistically with like, you know, perfect verisimilitude is impossible to emulate or predict anymore.
Perfect verisimilitude, he said.
How many doors are available right now? 57.
There's no way that a city of this size could support an inn of that magnitude.
Well, they're asking for payment in Electrum, so...
It's a local currency. You haven't heard of it.
It's crypto Electrum?
You know, if you do have imprisonment, or actually, frankly, any of these punishments, right, what does escape look like? You know, is it like Gotham, where your escape is pretty much expected within time for the next issue? You know, is everything super maximum security, like Azkaban? And are you expected to be disappearing into a hole? Obviously, as PCs, you don't want your story to end, so there has to be some way to evade punishment or endure it and move on with the story. But how common is that going to be in the world that you're living in? Are you the ones who escaped, or are you, oh, you're this week's escape?
When we're talking about, you know, seeding plot hooks and what you can feature in a city in a game, think about how corrupt is the legal system. You know, like if you run afoul of the law, it can be a hand wave thing where, okay, you've been caught by the guard and you're thrown in jail, and now we start talking about the jail scene. But you could be dealing with a trial, a sham trial, a fair trial. Any of those things are like ripe fodder for a session or two.
Yeah, and if it can be done to the PCs, perhaps they could do the same thing to somebody else, right? So, you know, is that something they have access to wield the corruption in their favor, or is it purely a threat that can be leveraged against them?
Right, trial by combat. You know, what are our strengths here?
Hey, you manufacture accusations against me, I'm manufacturing accusations against you. I got guys on my payroll too. I got goons.
Yeah, the goon union. The goon union.
Yeah. The goblin goonion.
Their rates are great.
You just got to pay the day rate. And expenses. And meals.
And exposure. Although you don't want to see the kind of exposure the goonion wants. Okay, and then you know, how much authority do those in charge wield in different areas of the city? You know, it might be very well that, you know, certain parts of the city are essentially unpoliced.
Yeah, or they're policed by, shall we say, non-legal authorities, right? You might find that it's actually safer to walk at night in some of the slums because, you know, a certain, you know, underlord is tightly policing crime, right? Like only the underlord's goons are able to commit acts of violence. So as long as you stay on the right side of them, you're actually pretty safe in that part of the city. Whereas, you know, it might be more of a free-for-all in some of like the middler districts.
Or, you know, we keep getting in scraps with the hardheads because like nobody likes them. And so right. Every time we try to walk around Sigil, they, you know, they come down pretty hard on us because like that's what they do. So
they don't like adventures. They keep beating us with billy clubs.
We keep shivving them. I don't know. They keep getting new recruits.
So another factor to think about in an urban adventure is privacy. What happens in a dungeon tends to stay in the dungeon, probably because it died there. The old dead men tell no tales. The only story that leaves the dungeon is the story of the adventurers, right? Nobody asks questions.
Tell that to a Sararak.
Fair enough. You know, in an urban environment, there's always a risk that somebody is watching or listening or following, right? There's people around and there's anonymity. So anybody could be a spy. Anybody could be an informant.
Yeah. When it comes to modern or sci-fi games, you always have to assume that, you know, surveillance is possible. High fantasy is the same thing. Like, a wizard can scry on you anytime, anywhere. But in the city, literally anybody can do it. You know, like, it's happening. It's definitely happening. There's a pickpocket on the other side of that door who just happens to overhear your master plan.
Right. Or, you know.
You happen to overhear a master plan.
Right. You're the pickpocket. You heard about the big score and you can beat them to it.
So think about what measures can the party take on both sides of this, right? Like, how do you leverage this to your advantage? If you're a rogue and, you know, you have a certain set of skills, well, you know, you now have an opportunity to use them. But also, how do you make sure that, yes, you're the big shot adventurers, but everyone knows you're the big shot adventurers and are going to be paying attention to literally every single thing that you do? You set a perimeter.
Yeah, obviously you secure the perimeter.
Mm-hmm, with grenades. In the city. People love that.
Well, we'll talk about that later.
Okay. Speaking of which, though, one thing you could do is try to be more anonymous.
Yeah, so cities, it's the double-edged sword, right? So on one hand, it can be easier to blend into the crowd in a city, right? Like, that's kind of a trope, is, you know, the light turns green and both sides, like, the foot traffic on both sides cross the crosswalk, and now you've lost the person you were tailing, right? Because you just lost them in the crowd of people on their way to work. And so, like, that makes sense, right? And you can use that to your advantage, or it can be a challenge that you need to overcome. But I think the other thing when we talk about the social aspects of cities is that it can be hard to get noticed, right? You might, even as an adventurer, you might blend into the crowd of rough and tumble adventurers, right? Like, that isn't necessarily the crowd that gets picked out by the king for dinner. You know, you might not be able to even get the attention of, like, you know, the constables if you notice that some, you know, cult is doing, you know, ritual murders. Like, they might not care because you're not paying their salary.
Ritual murders, join the club. You know how many people get ritually murdered in this city every week?
No, because the paper stopped reporting on it.
Yeah, well, you know, ritual murders at the printing
presses. Nobody can read.
I prefer ritual murders because they're easier to clean up. They're very predictable. You know, if you want to blend in a city, all you have to do is yell help. I'm being attacked, and everyone will turn the other way.
Correct. That's how you'd be truly anonymous. I think there's also, like, a lot of times, you know, games kind of start on the fringes of the empire or fringes of the kingdom or whatever, right? And they sort of push you in the direction of arriving in the capital. And, like, I think one of those tropes that kind of goes along with this is, like, you have arrived, but, like, nobody recognizes that, you know, a band of PCs walking through the gate and paying their tariff have arrived at all. You know, and that's like, okay, we fought, we scrapped, we got to the big city, and now we're right back at the bottom. You know, like, how do we accomplish what we thought was going to be easy because we're the big bad adventurers from the hinterlands, and we get here and we realize we're just five more random groups of elves, half elves, and dwarves.
Yeah, it's a small fish in a big pond, and right. it's a nice way to sort of throw the party off balance, but it's also a good change of pace when they've sort of, like, outgrown the, you know, low level environs of, you know, boar killing, and, you know, now they actually have to deal with savvy shopkeeps and people with, like, maintained arms and armor.
Right.
And then one thing that I think is often abstracted but can be something that you engage with on a, you know, pretty granular basis can be travel around a city, moving from one part of a city to another, moving through particular areas of the city that can potentially be dangerous. Think of, like, a slum or Look, talk to anybody who lives in a real life city and they'll tell you about the bad part of town where, you know, you shouldn't go at night and, you know, here are the routes to take, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you can easily extrapolate that to any kind of RPG setting.
And then also think about modes of transportation, right? That can be a really evocative and unique thing. Like, you know, if you think of like Sharn in Eberron, right? Like what stands out to me, it's the airships, right? Like it's the City of Towers and there's just airship traffic left, right, and center because it has so much verticality, right? Nowhere else is like that. In other cities, it might be the lightning rail. You know, you might have your horse and carriage, right? Like kind of your classic transport through cobblestones. Or it might be, you know, more like a cart and a donkey type of traffic if you're kind of more that Dark Ages sort of low fantasy feel.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, like when I think of Coruscant in Star Wars, the scenes that pop into my mind are like the mile high, essentially like airways where all these like flying speeders are zipping along and you have absolutely, you know, as an outsider, no idea what lane they're in. But, you know, people tend to not crash into each other, I suppose.
Right.
I think in and you can do whatever level of abstraction you want for this. Right. Like just describe evocatively how PCs get from one place to another. Or like, for example, the 3.5 Eberron book had tables where you rolled dice to see exactly how many minutes it would take to get from one section of the city to another section of the city, depending on like the altitude in the tower and your mode of transportation.
Right. I mean, this is you know, in wilderness environments, traditionally you use like random encounter tables, right? And there's no reason you can have a similar type of, you know, set of encounters within a city. In some ways, making it random in a city almost makes more sense than it does in the wilderness. But like, you know, it's kind of a question of like, what funny thing happened along the way, right? You were going from A to B, and like, what is the thing that stood out about that trip?
Oh, you're taking the 405? Roll 3d10 to see how long it takes you. What's traffic look like today?
Must be an LI if we're talking about the 405.
Did you say you turned on the radio to check the traffic? You didn't. All right, let's talk about some city encounters you could expect.
Encounters are often going to be dependent on which side of the law PCs want to find themselves. You know, are they breaking the law or are they upholding or maintaining or, you know, assisting the law?
You want to be above the boot, not below the boot.
They could literally be, you know, assisting the police or constabulary or whatever. Or they could just, you know, be doing the job of that the law should be doing, right? Like independent contractors or private eyes, that sort of thing. So again, these are often going to be themed around the people of the city. So classically is find somebody, right? For whatever reason, right? And then often that is followed by follow someone and figure out what they're doing. Like this might be the cheating spouse, or it might be the spy for the crown, or it might be, you know, the disloyal lieutenant. Any of those things, right? But the start of the plot is find this needle in the haystack and then figure out why that needle is interesting.
Yeah, and then it all begins to unravel because the person that we were following is either not the person that we thought they were in the first place or is not doing the thing that we thought they were doing in the first place. It's an easy way to lead to bigger stories.
Right.
You can play any genre in a city, but there are some genres that lend themselves toward cities. Noir, mystery, I think, is one that's great for cities just because you always want to be talking to people and there's so much detail that can be leveraged in a mystery, and there are lots of like tightly contained environments that you can set your mystery in.
Yeah, that's the thing about like a Knights Black Agents, right? Is like you could set one in like, you know, the farmlands of Romania or whatever, but like,
I mean, you know, you're gonna fight a vampire there, but you're probably not investigating much there.
Exactly. It's like, what is it? Like, it's kind of go to point A and learn what it is there, right? Like, there's limited opportunities to branch because everything is kind of the same, you know, like farm A and farm B are farms. Whereas if you set that in a city, like now there's, it's more about the people and the environment and the life of, you know, Budapest, that's informing what those options are and what those clues mean in a mystery. And obviously it means vampires, right? And all roads lead to vampires.
I think a lot of this boils down to, like, encounters in cities boils down to having so many different levers that you can use to send parties in different directions, or that as a party you can pull on. You know, this kind of depends on the kind of GM that you have, but there are so many pieces of the environment that are going to be interactive. Every person that you meet, and of course you're meeting tons and tons of people, or have the opportunity to anyway. Every object that you come across, you know, you can tell almost any kind of story that involves this interaction. Like, for example, political maneuvering. This is, you know, using the people in power within the city as the objects that you're interacting with. Or commerce and trade, which is using the merchants and the banks and the people who control the money in the city.
There could be religious maneuvering, right? Dealing with the temples and deities and priests and clerics of the various systems of belief and pantheons that might be in conflict or in harmony within the city.
The Church of the Sith and the Church of the Jedi aren't getting along, and it's weird. I feel like there's some animosity there.
I feel like this could end poorly.
I don't know. It's sort of a hokey religion over here.
Uh-huh.
Well, that could lead directly into committing a murder or an assassination. You know what? There are lots of shady things happening in cities, and maybe, you know, you have just the kind of party that wants to get in on some of that action.
Oh, yeah. That's the number one way that RPG players interact with people is by killing them. No different in cities.
We conducted a political murder for the greater good. So we're like privateers of assassins, you know?
Yes.
Right.
We have our letters of marked for dead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what a 00 is.
Yes. There are also, you know, a lot of the, like, encounters and plots that you can have in cities aren't directly related to people, right? So heists, people store their valuables in homes or safe houses or banks or guild halls. If it's valuable, go take it.
It's way more fun to do this in the city where there are potential witnesses. One, because it's cooler to pull off, but two, again, there are so many more things that could go wrong. So many more opportunities for planning and so many more resources available in the city. You could defend the city from attack. You know, cities are prime targets for pretty much everybody. So who is attacking? Why are they attacking the city? What defenses does the city have? I really like this question, especially when you're dealing with more modern types of cities that don't have, like, walls, you know, or even necessarily, like, clearly defined boundaries. And, you know, if there's some sort of invading army, aliens, or you know, tanks that suddenly crest over the horizon, how do you mount a defense of a modern city?
Right. And what preparations can be made, and what do you need to do in order to ensure that those preparations are successful, right? Whose palms do you need to grease? Who do you need to convince to that this is important?
You got to find the one little girl who somehow can communicate with Godzilla.
That's the only way.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you have a city, you have a lot of people, you could prevent or cause a catastrophe. This could be magical sabotage, explosives, anything like that. You know, pick the target, pick a motive for why it's necessary, or why the perpetrator believes it's necessary, and see what happens.
Yeah, I think this is an easy way to add tension. If you're planning for something sort of spectacularly bad to happen, consider where you were planning on setting it, and then think, what if I switch that to a city? And now suddenly you're dealing with all this collateral damage. Like if, you know, you think about in the movies how often, you know, the bomb is deflected or teleported or transported somehow to the middle of nowhere, like the farm or over the ocean or whatever. It's because when it explodes, nobody cares.
Right. It's slightly off the coast of San Francisco.
Just depends on how far enough off the coast. We put VX nerve gas in these rockets.
Do you like Elton John? You're the rocket man.
Okay. Let's talk about combat and fighting in cities.
So the physical environment, of course, is going to be dependent on that sort of like sublocation within the city. So you might have like very close confines in a slum or like the undercity. You might have these extensive sight lines and limited places to hide if you're in the rooftop. So like physically, it will depend on sort of what kind of place are you in.
Yeah, city fighting, I think, is probably my favorite, both from like an encounter planning perspective and from even like a battle map creator perspective. You know, like I love the top down view of the rooftops, and you know, you're labeling like exactly how, like, what is the vertical distance between this roof and the roof adjacent to it that's actually like 20 feet down, you know, and then like how far is it to the ground? Like, there's so much uneven terrain, and now you're dealing with skill checks and abilities and movement modes that so rarely have an opportunity to shine in most games.
A street lined with buildings is basically a hallway, right? But like you said, when you add the verticality to it, now it becomes something different. Right. And you can play with the directionality as well. Right. That's the other thing about a dungeon is they tend to be like linear. You're clearing a room and then moving forward. But like in a city, like the directionality changes all the time. Like a threat could come from the front or the side or behind or below or above. Right. You might turn the corner and a blind alley is actually a trap. You know, you might follow somebody into a dead end and be kind of surprised, right? And so that's where, yeah, like you get to throw all of that stuff in, right? It's not just the square with what makes this square different from the previous five squares.
Yeah, and you think like, okay, you could do this like, you know, in an elven forest where you're running along tree branches and like those are parallel and, you know, some of them are 40 feet below you and you can sort of jump laterally as well, but there's no real difference from branch to branch. It's just a question of like, do you make the jump? But in a city, every single branch, every single like road or rooftop or building is completely different. And every single one that you know, kick the window in and go inside, the environment is going to be completely different. Like if you think about it, in movies, they specifically like try to rein this in where, you know, they put the fight scene in narrow corridors inside, you know, a gambling den where there's only one entrance. And that's so that's to help the camera focus the story. But in an RPG, you don't need to do that. You can actually open it all up, make it expansive and have it so that the players aren't actually sure where the, like where potential attack is coming from, but also like where, you know, interesting bits of the story are coming from. They have to like keep moving and keep looking. I mean, though, it is the sewers. The sewers is where the cool stuff's happening.
Well, yeah, the sewers are probably the most dungeon-like, aren't they? If you have combat in a city, there's almost always going to be a question of legality. You know, most of your behavior is probably at least frowned upon in polite company, if not outright illegal. So think about what constraints that might put on what you can do in a fight. Like, you know, do you need to knock out opponents? Can you use magic or can you use weapons? Are swords okay, but guns aren't okay, right? Like, whatever the local custom is, like, you need to know, are you violating it? Are you escalating things or are you trying to stay within the confines?
Right. Were your weapons peace bonded when you entered the gates? Well,
right.
Something to consider. No one ever does a duel except in a city. Like these are the cool places where it's required by custom or by law. These are the places where you can have these interesting interactions. So, you know, do it while you can, because no one's going to insist in a duel when, you know, you're off in the Badlands.
Then something you alluded to earlier is collateral damage, both to people or property. How much is acceptable? You know, if a if a giant explosion goes off in a, you know, penthouse apartment, and then a T-Rex comes flying out the window and onto the ground, or I think a grizzly bear or something comes flying out of the window, landing on the ground below, turns into a man and then runs off. People might notice, you know, like the authorities in town, they might have to look into that, right? Like, they might not be able to just look the other way.
Or, you know, someone's going to have to write a report about mass hallucinations.
Right.
Or chalk it up to the Batman.
Right.
That guy.
Get me pictures of Spider-Man. The vigilante. So the question here is, like, what is the level of disturbing the peace that's going to prompt a reaction, right? And as PCs, are you trying to stay below that level? Or are you all in and you'll just deal with the consequences?
Yeah. How much heat are you generating? Sometimes literally and sometimes figuratively.
Yeah.
And I think you don't need to decide ahead of time what is the appropriate amount, or like what like commotion can the city absorb before, you know, someone sort of peeks in to see what's going on. You can calibrate that depending on what the PCs are doing. You know, like the first thing that they do is probably loud and flashy. That, like, set that to does not set off the alarms.
Right.
But set it to like just below sets off the alarms. And then, you know, they're always going to escalate from there. Make sure you're giving them an idea that, like, people are starting to notice, you know, are you going to dial this back, or are you going to go all out and then, you know, abscond and get out of town?
Yeah, you know, like, one fireball goes off in a crowded street. Everyone's like, okay, fine. You know,
it's,
like,
it's
it
a tragedy.
Yeah. But the second fireball catches all the roofs on fire, and now we got a real issue.
I heard there's an arsonist.
I can't have you burning down the horseshoe, okay?
Three fireballs.
People live there.
Right. Three fireballs and the insurance companies get involved.
Right. And then we mentioned vehicles and transportation earlier. Think about how those could be integrated into combat in a city, right? You know, is it a carriage chase through the streets? Is it, you know, fighting carriage to carriage while racing through the streets? Are, you know, airships or maybe boats in the harbor, right? Could they be involved? Another thing that I think is kind of a cool trope in a lot of fantasy cities is, like, if there's, like, literally two physical, like, levels of the city, right? Like a, like, built on like a mesa and then the lower city below it, like, you might have like an elevator, right? Or you might have just an elevator within a building, right? That might be an interesting confined place to have a fight. Or likewise, like a funicular, anything that kind of like moves people vertically.
Hood of a car, hood of a speeding car.
You're right.
I'm just leaving it there. That's do that.
Yes. An important thing to keep in mind is that a lot of times some PCs in the group will never have been to a city, or at least to that city. And so when they get there, it should convey that sense of like wonder and possibility, but also foreboding and repression and like constraint.
Yeah, cities often represent the worst elements of humanity, completely unrestrained, which are often contrasted with the, at least on the surface, noble intentions of the leaders or, you know, the reformers in the city lean pretty heavily into these elements. There's a reason that, like, Gotham City is, you know, so dark, and but also at the same time has these really, like, interesting, potentially relatable characters.
Yeah, and I think cities stand probably in contrast to the outlying villages and towns that the PCs, you know, venture through on their way. Like, those villages tend to end up harmonious, right? Like, usually the PCs are solving their biggest problem and then they can live happily ever after. Cities are crowded and tense. Like, they're not harmonious, right? Like, solving one problem doesn't solve any of the thousands of other problems. And so, like, PCs should always be looking over their shoulders, right? Because another problem might catch up to them.
Yeah, and this isn't a commentary on, like, real-life cities and, like, real-life small towns. The point is that what's interesting in a game is conflict. So if you have a utopian city where everyone gets along and it's actually really well run and clean all the time and the crime rate is low, you probably aren't going to go there in your game because there's not much to do.
Yeah, what's the adventure there?
Yeah.
I guess you could ruin it.
But I mean, yeah.
And then also just keep in mind sort of there's that streetwise element to like urban adventures, right? Where the streetwise characters sort of infer the lay of the land. They kind of pick up on like the subtle threats and power differences and understand how like people and money and power flow through the city. The foolish ones stumble headfirst into their problems and then have to confront them on their back foot, right? And that's how like the city as an environment pushes and pulls the party.
Yeah. Ultimately, like think of the city as an NPC. It is a character with a personality. It has its own actions. It has often its own motivations and goals, and leverage those to create an interesting story and interesting hooks for the party.
Yeah. And the way that it acts those out is through NPCs. So that's who they meet. All right. Do you hear that, Ishan?
It's the beating heart of the city. It's pizza parlors, actually. That's really sort of the best thing that you can expect.
I had pizza tonight, and we better move on to the character creation forge. I'm going to have to go get another slice.
Mm.
But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes.
All right, Shane. So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we're building the Urban Cowboy. What is that?
Okay, so you have not seen Urban Cowboy.
That is correct.
But I would venture there are two things you know about Urban Cowboy.
Okay.
One, the soundtrack.
Uh-huh, okay.
You might not know any of the songs on it, but you know it had one and it was important. Yeah?
Yeah, uh-huh.
There's dancing, revived country music, it was a whole thing.
Look, John Travolta was in it, and so you would expect.
There was dancing.
Yeah.
And second, I bet you know he rides a mechanical bull. Is that true?
I believe I remember that from the zeitgeist, sure.
Okay, perfect. So then you know everything you need to know about this character.
Wonderful. Okay. What do they do and what's the build?
Okay, so the build is Battlesmith Artificer 3, Redemption Paladin 10, College of Eloquence Bard 7.
A heavily armored John Travolta, okay.
Yeah, get ready to go on a little journey through the Wikipedia summary. Okay, we'll start with 5 levels of Paladin. That will get us Divine Sense to detect Celestials, Fiends, and Undead. And Lay on Hands up to 50 hit points. Second level, we'll get Smite and a Fighting Style, which, of course, you will take Duelist because he only ever fights one person, and it's Wes. So there's that.
You'll get Spellcasting up to 3rd level, Divine Health, Immunity to Disease, which is always helpful in a city. Let me just throw that out there.
Your Oath spells will include Sanctuary, which is, of course, the mobile home which John Travolta lives in with Sissy, Hold Person, Sissy, and Hypnotic Pattern, which I think we were all hypnotized by John Travolta's dancing.
Taking a really literal view of Hold Person, huh?
And Patsy Swayze's choreography. All right, we'll also get Channel Divinity. So we will get Emissary of Peace, which gives you plus 10 to Persuasion, not Deception. This is important because from the soundtrack, the eagles lion eyes, and you know you can't hide your lion eyes. Also, you'll get Rebuke the Violent. When an attacker damages someone other than you, you can use your reaction to reflect that amount of damage back to the target or back to the attacker as Radiant. They get to make a wisdom save for half damage.
You also get extra attack. And then 7 levels of Bard for Bardic Inspiration up to a D8 and 4th level spellcasting slots. Jack of All Trades, Song of Rest for an extra D6 HP to allies when resting.
And then College of Eloquence gets a Silver Tongue, which means if you roll below a 10 on a Persuasion or Deception check, you will act as though you rolled a 10. And then you will get Unsettling Words, which as a bonus action, you can roll your Bardic Inspiration to reduce the target's next saving throw that they make before your next turn. And now what's important here is we'll get Expertise. You will take, of course, Performance, because that's how you dance in D&D. And Persuasion, because, you know, why not? But you will not take Deception, because you can't hide your lion eyes. And you will not take Investigation, because you're looking for love in all the wrong places.
Jesus Christ. Okay. I don't want to hear anything about the puns in 99 bucks.
All right. You'll also get Font of Inspiration at 5th level, which lets you recover your inspiration dice on a short rest. And then 6th level, you get Counter Charm and Unfailing Inspiration. So your allies can keep their bardic dice when they use it and they still fail their roll. And then last of all, well, not last of all, but next, we'll get Universal Speech, which is once per long rest as an action. Up to your charisma modifier, number of creatures can understand your speech for 1 hour, because the urban cowboy speaks from the heart.
Adorable.
And that's a language that everyone can understand, Ishan.
Plus 4th level bard spells, like, I don't know, polymorph?
Yeah. All right. Then we'll take 5 more levels of Paladin to Paladin 10. We will get Aura of Protection. You and your allies will, within 10 feet, add your charisma modifier to your saving throws.
Your aura is of the Guardian. You can take a reaction to take damage on behalf of a creature within 10 feet of you. You're prescribing what we use the ASI for at level 8.
Oh, we are. Absolutely. Timing of this is important. So at level 8, you will take Skill Expert to get expertise in animal handling, not deception. You can't hide your lion eyes. Now that you have trained with Bob, who is the rodeo champion who trains John Travolta in order to win the mechanical bull riding competition.
All right. And then Aura of Courage. Your aura includes immunity to the frightened condition for you and your allies.
Do you know why, Ishan?
No, I have no idea.
Because when the night has come and the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see, you won't be afraid as long as you stand by me.
Yeah, I'm glad, though, that you thought this through.
I tried too hard.
You really did. All right, let's bring it home with Battlesmith 3. Why?
You got to bring a mechanical bull, my dude.
Okay. And you're going to fight with intelligence?
Well, no.
No, okay.
That's an option to fight with intelligence, which you will not take.
All right, so you get the cool artificer stuff, some spell casting, magical tinkering. You can infuse 2 items. You'll know 4 infusions, though.
Right. And then you'll get right tool for the job at 3rd level, which lets you conjure thieves or artisans' tools after an hour. What we are here for is battle ready. Nope. Just kidding. You also get Battlesmith and Battle Ready, which give you Smith's Tools proficiency. And as you mentioned, you can use your intelligence to attack. But don't. We don't. We're taking 13 intelligence. It's the minimum. We're not smart. But at level 3, you get your Steel Defender, which is a medium construct that only has 18 hit points. But since you are a Hollywood star and therefore a small-sized creature, you may ride it.
Do you have your own bull?
Yes.
I don't hate it. I don't hate it.
I think the Steel Defender, like, the art of it is more like a dog. So you might have your own bulldog, but that's close enough. A mechanical bulldog.
I do believe that the text specifically says you can make it look like whatever you want.
Perfect.
All right. I am strangely proud of you.
Please get me out of here. All right. Before we wrap up, let's take a moment and thank our Patreon supporters.
Your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. And supporters at any level get access to our bonus content, our plot hooks of the week, and all the previous episodes. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
And don't forget, send in any mailbag questions you have for episode 300. Only a few weeks left. And what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We are talking about using demons in your game.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building Fire Walk With Me.
Well, that's it for episode 295 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.
I feel like a Rama is an urban cowboy, right? Okay, even if we've narrow cast for one, it's fine.